You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Menendez with NewsHour. If confidence is key for the financial markets, then that's in very short supply when it comes to the situation in Greece. Bad news keeps piling up on bad news. Yesterday it was the decision by the ratings agency Standard & Poor's to downgrade Greek debt to what's known as junk status. Today that's prompted the cost of financing the debt to jump from an already high 14% to more than 20%. In other words, a country that's struggling to pay its debts will now find it even harder. And that's bad news for all of us, because there are real fears that the Greek crisis could drag the wider global economy down with it. Well, for a look at today's reaction in the financial markets, I've been speaking to Howard Wealdon, senior strategist at BGC Partners.
Equity markets have behaved in the manner that is very appropriate to the seriousness of the situation. They have continued to fall across Europe, although it has to be said, not by as much as we might have expected them to do first thing in this morning. So I think there is a signal there that that the worst of this primary affair may be over. It's being thrown back into the court of the European Union. It is for them to initially sort out this problem and to get their act together. So I think markets are probably taking the view that that something good might come out of this further down the line, but they're not holding their breath. On the other hand, of course, bond markets have continued to, as you have alluded, take extreme pressure.
Do markets still have faith in the euro as a sustainable currency? Is that a worry for investors?
I think they have it. They have faith in the euro where it can work for in a collegiate fashion. But when one part of the jigsaw fails and it is proven to have failed, as in the case of Greece, I don't think the euro has been beneficial for the Greek crisis in any shape or form. That is where markets begin to worry that the model is seriously wanting, and it is wanting. There's been, I think, extreme failure all round on this, particularly on the basis that we find that of all the rhetoric, the great agreement that appeared to have been announced a week ago and included the International Monetary Fund, which is the right thing to do, behind it, though, there is no mechanism to speed the process up. And speed is of the essence in these sort of situations, because markets don't like being held on the end of a string.
Howard Wealdon. Well, in Greece itself, there is deep unease about the idea of an international bailout. Few people are prepared to accept the kind of spending cuts the government wants to introduce in order to bring down the country's debt. That's brought many people out onto the streets in recent weeks. Today, thousands of civil servants took part in a demonstration in Athens. Some were actually calling for the government to default on its debt so that, in their view, banks paid the price instead of working people. Our Athens correspondent Malcolm Brabant was there.
Listen well, Brussels, shouted the demonstrators. We will be victorious. The austerity measures will never be implemented. That was one of the more polite chants of the marchers, who were shadowed all the way through central Athens by riot police. Down with the junta of banks, they yelled, angry that the international markets have forced Greece to surrender its fiscal independence.
We were against IMF and Goldman Sachs and Wall Street measures that reduce the salaries of the working people and increase the profits of the rich people. We must make bankruptcy Goldman Sachs, Wall Street. They lend us the money, Deutsche Bank. They have to lose their money and not the people lose their jobs.
They want us to live with less salaries, more taxes, with the unemployment which reaches the 20% in this country. They want this country to live without a future.
The IMF's message that Greeks have nothing to fear from their involvement in the rescue plan has clearly fallen on deaf ears. Although this was a comparatively small, peaceful, if tense demonstration, many more are likely to follow as anger grows over national humiliation and the imposition of new belt tightening. Greece has a history of resistance to outside forces, and the fact that there's a strong groundswell of popular opinion that the country should default will do nothing to ease the nervousness of the markets.
Malcolm Brabant in Athens. Well, despite those views, the EU and the IMF have been trying to put together a package of loans to help Greece service its debts and to calm those markets. But the size of those loans keeps going up, which isn't going down well in Germany, Europe's largest economy. They've been asked to contribute $8 billion to the bailout package. And given the turbulence of the past 24 hours, will Germany now move quickly to help out? A question for our Berlin correspondent, Steve Rosenberg.
Well, in a newspaper interview today, the German finance minister said that Germany wouldn't let Greece down and would push hard for a rescue package. But I have to say that the perception has been, up till now, that Germany has been dragging its feet over this bailout for a whole number of reasons, and that despite all the problems on the money markets, the fears of a meltdown in the eurozone, Berlin still hasn't come out and said that it's ready to write that cheque, a very hefty cheque of €8 billion, to Athens. Now, to explain the German government's position, earlier today I spoke to German MP Jörg van Essen. He's a senior member of the Free Democrats, one of the parties in the governing coalition. And I asked him first whether Germany would eventually agree to help bail out Greece.
Oh, it's a difficult question. We have, at the moment, the IMF, the European Central Bank and the Commission checking the Greek situation. We will get the result on Sunday, and then we have the basis for decision. It's too early at the moment to say if we should bail out the Greeks, but of course it's in our common interest that we don't weaken the euro.
But isn't this hesitation, this reluctance to rush in with a rescue, isn't that unsettling the markets? I mean, time is running out before Greece will be forced to declare bankruptcy.
But we are the advocates of the German taxpayer as a Liberal Party. And the feeling of the people is we saved money in the last years. The public servants have no 13th salary in a year. The pension age is 67 in Germany, and the feeling is there should be a lot of actions in Greece to change the situation in which Greece is.
But what about the question of European solidarity? I mean, judging from what happened yesterday with the Greek debt being downgraded to junk, yes, and the credit rating of Portugal also being cut, this looks as if it's contagious and spreading across Europe, and Germany still hasn't decided whether it's going to sign up to a bailout or not.
We know that. We know how important European solidarity is, and so it's possible at the end that we will play our part we have to play. But we can take the decision only if we have clear results from the checking by the institutions. They do the check at the moment. But will they have the result on Sunday, and on Monday the government will decide?
Well, Steve, Mr. van Essen says there that the German government will decide on Monday, but can Greece and indeed the financial markets wait that long?
Well, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it, that with European stock markets today suffering fresh losses, and with growing fears of that this crisis spreading to Portugal, possibly to Spain and to other eurozone countries, that anyone would want to wait until Monday, and certainly not until May the 10th, which is when European heads of state are supposed to meet in Brussels to discuss the whole crisis. I think there will be pressure on Angela Merkel today from the IMF chief, from the European Central Bank, to come out and make a strong, firm statement that Germany is on board, that Germany will back 100% this bailout.
How much is national politics in Germany playing a part in all this? Is some of this reluctance a response to a feeling that public opinion just isn't in favour of helping Greece out?
Yeah, I suspect that national politics is playing a rather large part in this reluctance of the German government to rush in and rescue the Greeks, because on May the 9th, in Western Germany, there is a very important regional election in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, an election which the governing coalition of Angela Merkel can't really afford to lose. And she knows, and the government knows here, that bailing out the Greeks is not popular. The idea is not popular with the German public. She doesn't want to lose votes. And I think that's why she had been hoping that this issue could have been dragged on past the election. But it looks like the German government has to make up its mind now, sooner rather than later. And so there is concern on the part of the governing coalition that it could lose them votes in that election.
That was Steve Rosenberg in Berlin. Now, to a form of cancer that's not talked about very often, perhaps because it makes people feel squeamish. But bowel cancer is the third most deadly in the world, accounting for more than 600,000 deaths every year. Here in the UK, there's a screening programme for people who show early symptoms of the disease. But now scientists say they've come up with a much better way of dealing with it by actually preventing the cancer from developing in the first place. Professor Wendy Atkin is from Imperial College here in London. She led the research. So, how do you prevent bowel cancer?
Well, we know that bowel cancer develops from polyps, and polyps develop in the bowel in people's 50s and slowly over several decades become cancerous. If you give an examination of the bowel just once in your 50s and find all those polyps and remove them during the screening procedure, it looks from our research that you get long-term protection against the development of colorectal cancer, of bowel cancer.
Is it a complex procedure?
It's a very simple procedure. It involves a flexiscope. It's a thin, flexible tube that's inserted into the bowel. It's got a light on the end that transmits an image to a television monitor where you can see the inside of the bowel clearly. And any polyps that are seen can be removed there and then, unless, of course, they're large or numerous, in which case we suggest another test.
And how effective is it? Is it something you'd recommend everyone should have?
Well, if the Department of Health decided to implement this, this would be for everyone. We suggest that it would be very helpful because we found that it reduced incidence by a third and mortality by 43%. There isn't anything quite as effective as that around.
It sounds like, though, that if it was a screening programme for everyone at the age that you talked about, that it could be very expensive for governments to introduce.
Well, yes, the capital outlay might be large. However, the test itself is not particularly expensive. And because it prevents cancer, it actually avoids the treatment costs associated with the disease. And an independent Department of Health economic analysis showed you'd actually save money for every single person screened.
This would all be good news for people in the UK, but people around the world listening, I mean, if there's no testing, what should they do?
Well, actually, countries around the world are now beginning to introduce bowel cancer screening, colorectal cancer screening, and they've been waiting for the results of this study to decide which form of screening they should introduce. So it will be interesting to see what decisions are made.
And that was Professor Wendy Atkin from Imperial College here in London. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Menendez, and this is NewsHour. Coming up later on NewsHour, our reporter joins the millions of people taking part in the world's biggest religious festival.
It's early in the morning and I'm standing knee-deep in the river, surrounded by people immersing themselves in the holy water and submitting offerings to the gods of flowers and incense. The Kumbh Mela really is an extraordinary event. It's chaotic, it's crowded, but it carries real meaning.
More from India a little later, but first a reminder of our main news this hour. The head of the International Monetary Fund is having talks with the German government as efforts continue to contain the financial crisis in Greece. And there have been more clashes in Bangkok between anti-government demonstrators and Thai troops. A soldier has been shot dead. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is NewsHour with James Menendez. Now, it's just over a week until Britain's general election. So far, the campaign has been dominated by a series of televised debates between the party leaders. But today, the Prime Minister Gordon Brown has been making all the headlines for the wrong reasons, after making unguarded comments in which he described a member of the public who just confronted him as bigoted. The remarks were picked up because Mr. Brown hadn't removed his microphone. Here's what he said to an assistant after the confrontation.
Should never have put me with that woman. Whose idea was that?
No, I didn't see
her. It's Sue, I think. It's just ridiculous.
I'm not sure they'll go with that one.
They will go with it.
What did she say?
everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman. Said she used to be Labour. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, on the line now is our political correspondent, Naomi Grimley. Naomi, how bad is this for Gordon Brown?
Oh, there's no doubt this is a toe-curling moment for the Prime Minister. It really is. And we've seen that already. I mean, he's gone on national radio to apologise to this lady. When he did so, he had his head in his hands because he knows it looks so bad. He's also made a personal apology to the woman who's called Gillian Duffy. But we know from speaking to her in the last hour that she is not going to vote Labour, perhaps unsurprisingly, after this embarrassing incident.
Has there been any reaction from the other main parties?
Well, the other main parties don't need to react because, as they say, the incident speaks for itself and they're just enjoying watching Mr. Brown being put through this embarrassment. So they're not trying to exploit it in any way. They're saying it just really stands testimony to the Prime Minister's behaviour. I think, really, James, there are two reasons why this looks bad. The first is, obviously, it's not very good public relations to be insulting a voter. But secondly, this just makes the Prime Minister look hapless and accident-prone. And on an election campaign, when it's important to be seen as being media-savvy and slick in the way that you deal with the media, this is just, as the Prime Minister himself said, a disaster.
Can small incidents, or apparently small moments like this, make much difference to an election campaign?
Oh, they can. I mean, history is littered with examples of gaffes, both here in Britain and in America, where people have said things and not realised that they were being filmed by the media. But that is why it is all the more important for politicians to remember when they're wearing microphones and when their comments can be picked up by live TV, live radio. It's all the more important that they make sure that they're saying things that they don't want to be broadcast around the nation.
Well, I wonder whether it also plays to a perception that politicians say one thing in public but another in private, that they're not always genuine with the potential voters that they meet.
Well, yes, James, I think you've hit on another thing, exactly. There's a real distrust of politicians in general. And another reason why it was so embarrassing for Mr. Brown is when he was actually speaking face-to-face with this woman, Gillian Duffy, he was actually being very pleasant to her. He commented on her lovely coat and he was laughing too with her. And yet, when he gets in the car a few minutes later, he's calling her a bigoted woman. And that is just so embarrassing because it gives the impression that the Prime Minister says one thing and does another.
OK, thank you very much, Naomi. That was our political correspondent, Naomi Grimley, there. Well, during the election campaign, there's been also a lot of talk about how Britain is a divided country. Fairness is a slogan often bandied around by all the political parties. But just how fair is British society? And what influences people's ability to get on in life? Is class still the factor it once was? Nina Robinson's been investigating.
I look down on him because I am upper class. I have got innate breeding.
I know I live in a great place. I work in a great firm. Yes, I'm very fortunate.
I look up to him because he is upper class. I am middle class.
Hello, my name's Dave Smith. I live in the centre of England and I'm an accountant.
But I look down on him because he is lower class.
My last job was about a year and a half ago. I was born in the East End. So I'll be a working class person.
I know my place.
The traditional British class system, as illustrated by John Cleese and the Two Ronnies in a 1966 comedy sketch, was a rigid hierarchy based on job, family, education and wealth.
Good morning, Alexander Dickinson's office.
Alexander's family business is law.
I knew it was expected of me. I mean, not expected of me by my father, but expected of me by everybody who knew me, who all thought, well, bound to do whatever father or grandfather's done.
In accountancy, I have to deal with people from all different kinds of backgrounds.
Dave Smith came to his equally rewarding profession from a very different family and income starting point.
My dad worked in steel construction, saw the British Steelworks close.
Yeah. And so there is a lot of poverty in those areas.
Yeah. You know what I mean? My mum was a housewife. It's always going to be harder for somebody if you're born poor.
My mum, she worked in a post office for 30, 40 years. My dad was in a building trade.
Expectations in Cliff Anthony Seagree's family in East London were lower as he has struggled to make a living as an artist.
What I would hear and what I would see, not just from my parents, but from the general attitude around this area, you know, it's like, be an artist, it's not a real job.
Alexander lives in an 18th century house on a 700-acre plot of land with his two young daughters, teenage son Andrew and wife Annabelle, who's cooking for the girls as we arrive.
I am making some tea to drink for my husband and I and giving my young children their tea to eat. Do you actually call it that they are eating their tea? You don't say this is their dinner?
No, I call this their tea.
Okay. But when they're older, probably, and it would be, and so they were having it later, I'd probably call it supper.
Do you think that there is like a class distinction in these terms?
I think things are said in different ways.
Silly things, no, and it doesn't matter, and it's not important at all, but it's just a way of, you can sort of slightly tell, or where they've come from.
Annabelle can tell who the middle classes are, but for Dave, the class divides are less visible. He thinks that the route up the ladder is through education, but is this an opportunity equally available to all?
The school I went to, there were rough people, there were people that were punching their faces, look at you, and there were nice people as well. But I mean, at our school, there was three people who went to Oxford at our school.
I go to a school called Harrow in North London, and it's my second year there so far.
Alexander sends his son to a school which charges $44,000 a year.
And you can just do so much, so much. Like last year, I think they went climbing Kilimanjaro for one of the school trips.
Seven British prime ministers also went to this same school. Some might say you're buying connections.
You develop a lot of relationships which will impact on your future life.
It's very, very cliquey.
Cliff left school at 16 and feels shut out of the club.
You know, it's like, I'm from this area, I'm from this background, and I'm going to stay here. You know, working class as well as the upper class, the aristocracies, some of them feel comfort in where they are.
If the wealthy are comfortable in the company they keep, and the lower classes feel they should stay where they belong, and those in the middle feel there's potential to move up, then despite all the talk from politicians of a fairer society, there really is still not much difference in attitudes in 2010 to the comedy sketch of the 60s.
That was Nina Robinson reporting, and you can hear the full version of Nina's report in this week's assignment here on the BBC World Service. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with us here on NewsHour, we welcome your comments, particularly interested in what you think about those unguarded remarks by Gordon Brown we heard about a little earlier. The email address is worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, or you can text us via your mobile phone if that's easier, 44 77 86 20 60 80. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Menendez with NewsHour. There's been further unrest in Thailand today. After weeks of instability, the standoff between the government and protesters who want fresh elections to be called shows no sign of being resolved. Earlier, Thai troops fired warning shots during a confrontation with one group of demonstrators. The incident happened after the group of about 2,000 protesters headed north in a convoy from the centre of the capital, Bangkok. One soldier was killed, although reports suggest he was killed inadvertently by one of his colleagues. One protest leader, Natawut Saikua, said they'd been trying to garner more support.
We're conducting an offensive strategy, going out to see our citizen brothers and sisters, to explain to them and make them understand the fight of the red shirts, and to ask them to join us in the fight.
And in a BBC interview on Tuesday, the Thai Prime Minister Abhisit Wichitiwa said the situation was calming down.
Compared to what has been happening over the last month or so, I think the situation has improved markedly. Obviously, there continues to be some activities on the part of protesters. But as far as the overall picture is concerned, a lot of attention now is in the middle of Bangkok, in the Rajprasong intersection. And that's what we have to continue to address. Of course, there are some movements of red shirt demonstrators outside Bangkok. But on the whole, there are minor incidents. And compared to last month, I think the situation has markedly improved.
Our correspondent Rachel Harvey is in Bangkok, and earlier I asked her if the situation in the city was improving.
Well, the Prime Minister is right in the sense that for the past few days, things have felt relatively calmer. But what passes for calmer in Bangkok these days is still that there are several thousand anti-government protesters entrenched in the camp in the area that they've occupied in the central district of Bangkok. They've barricaded themselves in. They are digging in and preparing for a fight because they are absolutely convinced, the protesters, that a security operation against them is imminent. The security forces are out on the streets of Bangkok in large numbers, both riot police and armed soldiers. So that is what has come to be thought of here as relatively calm until today. But it shows you just how tense things are and how quickly things can escalate when the two sides confront each other, that it really wasn't that long after the two sides came together in large numbers that shots were fired.
Are there any more details about the soldier who was killed today?
Our understanding is, from talking to an eyewitness on the ground, is it seems as if some soldiers riding motorbikes were coming from the protester side through their lines towards the security forces. Now, we're told that this was during a relative lull in the standoff, so they were coming back to their own side, presumably having been let through the lines by the red-shirted protesters. As they approached the security forces, there was firing, and one soldier was hit in the head and subsequently died. The eyewitnesses that we've spoken to suggest that this was a friendly fire incident. The armed forces won't confirm that. They will only confirm that a soldier was shot in the line of duty. They won't confirm the circumstances, but it seems as if this may have been an accident and a friendly fire incident.
And that was our correspondent Rachel Harvey in Bangkok. Now, the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is spreading, and Coast Guards warn that it could hit shores by the weekend. Robot submarines have so far failed to shut off the flow more than 1,500 metres below the sea following the fatal explosion last week. In Washington, the Obama administration has launched a full investigation into what threatens to become one of the worst spills in US history. Coast Guard Petty Officer Thomas Blue is part of the team in Louisiana. Earlier, he described the continued efforts to deal with the oil slick.
This morning, the oil slick is approximately 36 miles south of Venice, you know, Louisiana. With the favorable weather conditions, it's actually pushing the sheen out a little bit. Our goal is to fight the oil slick as far offshore as we possibly can, and with the weather cooperating, it allows us more time to clean up existing product on the water, so that's a wonderful thing. As of now, we have 49 vessels responding and 16 aircraft. Down on the seafloor, we have 6 remotely operated vehicles, which are currently trying to activate blowout preventers down on the wellhead. And the blowout preventers are stalled mechanisms designed to stop leaks of this kind. Each day, we deploy an increased amount of containment boom. We spray increased amounts of oil dispersants, which basically help break up the oil that's on the surface. It helps break it up naturally. And that way also it allows for us to work on other areas of the spill and contain that and clean it up.
But as efforts to stop the leaking oil falter, Coast Guards are now considering other, more radical options.
The Unified Command is currently coming up with a plan for what they call an in-situ burn. In-situ burn is basically a controlled burn. They don't go out and light the entire oil sheen on fire. What they do is they take about 500 feet of containment boom and they grab a section of oil on the surface and pull it away from the affected area. In the past, these in-situ burns have burned about 90% of the oil. And they've also found that this is better for the environment.
Well, I spoke to Louisa Wood from the United Nations World Conservation Monitoring Centre and began by asking her what sort of impact oil slicks like this one could have on the environment.
It's very hard to tell at the moment in terms of what the impact would be. It's important to recognise that there's a lot of wetland habitat in the Gulf of Mexico, and those are actually very important habitats for various reasons.
Why are they so important then?
Well, they provide a huge range of what we term ecosystem services, which means they provide a range of services that are of direct benefit to humans, including things like the production of food, the provision of nursery habitat for fisheries, for species that are important for fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico. They also can do a lot of waste processing and provide some flood protection. Finally, they also provide a carbon storage function, which means that they can actually be really important in terms of mitigating against climate change because they can hold a lot of carbon that we may be emitting through our other activities.
If the oil were to reach shore, are the means in place to clean it up? Is it easy to do?
I think it really depends on the environment that it actually hits and the different bioremediation activities that might be undertaken in the region. It really depends on the environment that you're looking at. So with rocky shoreline, for example, you would have to implement quite different techniques than in wetlands, for example.
Can some of these important areas recover from oil slicks? I mean, what's been the experience in the past?
Well, certainly recovery does happen. The question is over what time frame, and the time frame is a function of many things, including the frequency of exposure and the level of experience, if you like, of the ecosystem to these types of impacts, as well as the intensity of the impact and also the, you know, just the full extent of it. But, you know, recovery is a relative thing.
What about this idea that we heard of burning the slick before it reaches land? I mean, from your point of view, is that a good option?
I think it's one of the options. These things always require us to make difficult decisions. Certainly, the risk of a large flow on the coast is undesirable, so it's really a question of the local agencies doing a kind of cost-benefit analysis of the various potential impacts of the different options available to them.
Louisa Wood. Now, will stability return to Kyrgyzstan? It's a question being asked by everyone in this Central Asian state. And also outside, the country is strategically important because it plays host to both American and Russian military bases. But after the recent uprising against the government of Kurmanbek Bakiyev, fears of further violence persist. Rehan Dimitri reports from Kyrgyzstan.
It's daytime Bishkek. The spring has arrived. The trees turn green. The birds are singing and there's plenty of sunshine. I'm standing in one of the parks. I can see lots of young people here eating ice cream. Looking at this peaceful scenery, it's really difficult to imagine that just a few weeks ago there was chaos and gunfights in the streets of Bishkek. ...85 people were killed and hundreds more injured when security forces opened fire against anti-government protesters in Bishkek in early April. Thousands of angry men marched to the capital. They were furious at President Bakiyev's corrupt government, but they also wanted a way out of years of crippling poverty. ...28-year-old Yildiz lost her husband that day. Looking at his photograph, one of several dozen attached to the iron fence that surrounds a government building, the scene of deadly protests, she sobs.
Last time I spoke to him, it was around 2 p.m. Then he spoke to his mother. But after that, he stopped answering his phone.
Now, men and women like Yildiz want to be assured their husbands and sons didn't die in vain. Since Kurmanbek Bakiyev fled the country, the provisional government's biggest challenge has been restoring law and order. But it's a tough road. The revolutionary movement was made up of thousands of rural poor. Many of them looted the city in the first few nights after the uprising, which they saw as reward for participating. And now many of their families remain encamped on the outskirts of town, laying claim to small plots of land on private property. The provisional government cannot risk alienating its support base. But another darker threat looms on Kyrgyzstan's horizon, the risk of inter-ethnic conflict. 2 weeks after the mass protests, an angry mob numbering in their thousands overran a largely Turkic community in the village of Mayevka, near Bishkek. Narhan is an ethnic Turk. Her house was destroyed in the violence.
When we heard the crowds, I took the children and ran away. They took away everything and set the house on fire. We said, we're not giving away our land. They were saying, go away, Turks.
As Narhan recalled the events of that day, she felt unwell. 5 people died in the violence in Mayevka. Local police chief Kanat Jumagaziev says his unit was simply outnumbered.
We did not have enough men, and I had to ask for reinforcement. Then we intervened and arrested 130 people.
Military convoys are still patrolling the streets of Bishkek. The interim government says that the security situation is now under control. But when dusk falls, the streets empty, as many fear violence may erupt at any time. Patrolling the streets at night in private cars and vans, young men are helping police restore order. The vigilante teams say public trust in the security services has faded after police shot at protesters during the uprising.
My name is Yuri Andreev. People feeling, you know, still feeling scary. We try to protect our city.
Insecurity, poverty and ethnic tension. The de facto government of Kyrgyzstan has a big job to deliver its promises of a better life for its people. It will need to persuade the international community that the millions of pounds in aid and investment it is requesting will be well spent, and that it has the legitimacy and competence to bring peaceful change to Kyrgyzstan.
Rehan Dimitri reporting. For the last 20 years or so, anyone suffering from HIV or AIDS hasn't been allowed into China. It wasn't the only country with a ban like this, though. The United States also had similar restrictions. Well, they've lifted theirs, and now the Chinese authorities have too, saying it didn't reflect current knowledge of the virus and hadn't had much effect in limiting its spread. Graham Smith, who's the China director of the International HIV/AIDS Alliance, based in Yunnan province in the southwest of China, gave me his reaction to the ban being lifted.
It's terrific news. Really welcome the decision. It's a commendable decision on the part of the Chinese authorities.
But a decision that's been a long time coming, I imagine.
Well, not as long as it took in the States, if you consider that the Chinese epidemic was at least a decade behind the epidemic in the States, and this decision is only a few months behind the policy change in the United States. So I think it's very progressive.
And why do you think the Chinese authorities have done it? Is it a response to what the US has done? Some have said that perhaps it's because the Shanghai World Expo is about to open, and it was for that reason.
I think this has been deliberated for a number of years now. I remember in the province where we worked, the Global Fund held a community forum a couple of years back. And at the time, they had to make exceptions in order to enable HIV-positive participants to take part in that meeting. And it was already pledged at that time that this policy would be reviewed, and it was on the cards to be lifted. So I don't think this is a knee-jerk response to either of those developments. It's been on the cards for a while now.
I wonder why, though, they didn't perhaps change it before the Beijing Olympics, when China really was in the full glare of the international spotlight.
Well, perhaps they were busy with all the logistical arrangements of getting that humongous event off the ground.
It seems then, from what you're saying, that it's a sign that official attitudes to HIV/AIDS have changed in China. But are there still problems for sufferers? Are sufferers still stigmatised?
I think the value of a policy like this being lifted is the fact that it sends out a very clear message that discrimination against people with HIV/AIDS is not an effective way to control an epidemic, and it's a real barrier to prevention. What we're seeing here on the ground is that stigma is the number one factor that's preventing communities getting access to the services that the Chinese government has committed to providing.
So you think it will filter down to local areas?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very clear message that stigma of this, discrimination of this sort, is totally unacceptable.
That was Graham Smith of the International HIV/AIDS Alliance speaking to me from southwest China. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Menendez, and this is NewsHour. reminder of today's main news. The head of the International Monetary Fund will shortly address German members of parliament to try to overcome doubts about a rescue package for Greece. The president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, said all the necessary steps were being taken to help the Greek economy.
Our governments are fully committed to provide support to Greece to ensure the stability of the Eurozone. And I am fully confident Greece will receive on time from the IMF and the European Union the financial assistance it needs to implement its adjustment program and to preserve the stability of the euro area.
And one other headline, there have been more clashes in Bangkok between anti-government demonstrators and Thai troops. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour from the BBC. Well, more now on our main story. And one group of politicians that's feeling perhaps a little smug about what's happening in Greece is Britain's UKIP, or the UK Independence Party. As the name suggests, they want Britain to leave the European Union, saying that the institutions of the EU have taken away too much power from the Parliament at Westminster. Having said that, they do have 13 seats at the European Parliament. But they maintain that the crisis in Greece proves that a single currency isn't viable. Nigel Farage is the party's former leader and now chief spokesman.
We predicted this in the European Parliament 2 years ago, and I remember being shouted down by everybody, but I was warning then about the bond spreads and about the fact something serious was going to happen. It looks like a bit of a catastrophe. I mean, when the chief economist of Deutsche Bank says that it is a death spiral of sovereign debt in southern Europe, you realise how bad things are. Whatever the EU or the IMF try to do, even if they can plug the gap, the problem will remain that Greece is stuck inside an economic prison that is called the euro. And my feeling is that unless they get the drachma back, unless they get some control of their economy back, then I fear that we will see civil disorder in Greece of a magnitude that is perhaps difficult for us to imagine.
So you think Greece should leave the single currency?
Oh, absolutely. They should never have joined in the first place. I mean, the euro was doomed from day one. Because you've got so many different types of economy within it, it was never going to work. And this is not just about Greece. This problem is going to afflict Portugal. It will probably afflict Spain as well. Countries need to leave the euro if they are going to survive economically.
Wouldn't that cause a massive headache for people living in Europe? It would cause massive instability, wouldn't it? And it would be bad for everyone, surely.
Well, look, you know, the Eurosceptics like UKIP said 10 years ago this could not work, and thank goodness Britain did not make the mistake of joining. Otherwise, we would be in a very similar position to Greece. Of course, the breakup of the euro will cause dislocation. But, you know, that isn't our fault. We warned from the beginning that it wasn't going to work. And unless they get the drachma back, unless they're able to significantly devalue, then I'm afraid, because there's nothing the Greek voters can do to change things, that all they're left with is civil disorder. And that must be the real worry here.
But doesn't this matter for Britain, regardless of whether we're out of the euro, which we are, or indeed whether we're out of the European Union, which UKIP want?
Well, of course it matters, because how our trading partners do matters to us enormously. We do business with all
these
people.
Well, exactly. Don't we want a strong Europe that can compete with countries like China, India,
and of course the United States. I think actually what we want is we want a strong and stable Germany and France and Greece and everywhere else. And the idea that you could take all these different political structures, all these different people, all these different economies and force them into one, and that somehow that would produce a benefit, was political and economic idealism that is now today being exposed to be entirely wrong.
Are you happy then to be using what's happening in Greece as you portray it, the crisis with the euro in your election campaign? Do you think it'll benefit you?
I think this should be the centrepiece of the British general election campaign. After all, the Lib Dem surge has happened because people are saying a plague on both your houses. The real choice for the alternative vote in Britain should be, do you go for UKIP or do you go for the Lib Dems? The Lib Dems are euro fanatic and would have had us in the euro 10 years ago. That should be debated publicly.
You never do very well in British general elections, do you? You've never won a seat, indeed, at Westminster.
Well, I mean, you know, this time last year, little UKIP, much derided, came second across the entire United Kingdom, even beating the governing party of the day. Nothing like it had ever happened before in British politics. We go into this general election being denied access, despite that performance, to any of the leaders' debates, so we are at a disadvantage, but I have a feeling that if this debate about Greece really gets out there in the British media, you could see that swing to the Lib Dems suddenly become a swing to UKIP.
Nigel Farage of UKIP. Well, RP Reuters emailed us to say nobody in Europe cares a hoot about contagion from the Greek crisis. It's a matter for the Greek government. Anybody who lends money to Greece should have his head examined. And on the question of Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, British Prime Minister's remarks recorded saying that a lady he met on the campaign trail was bigoted, we had this from Judy in New York. As a New York liberal, I don't think what Gordon Brown said was so bad. I'm glad that he recognised that woman as bigoted, assuming she was, and found it distasteful. Isn't that better than thinking that a bigot was the sort of person he wants to be seen with? Let us know what you think. World have your say at bbc.com. Now, it's the world's biggest religious festival, and it reaches its climax today. India's Kumbh Mela attracts millions of people who will take their turn to bathe in the river Ganges at the town of Haridwar. Our South Asia correspondent, Chris Morris, is also there.
It's early in the morning and I'm standing knee-deep in the river, surrounded by people immersing themselves in the holy water and submitting offerings to the gods of flowers and incense. The Kumbh Mela really is an extraordinary event. It's chaotic, it's crowded, but it carries real meaning. I've just met up with a young Hindu holy man from Punjab, Sri Bolagiri Nagababa. He was wearing a saffron lungi and carrying a metal trident in his hand. He says he's here in search of peace.
People come here to get closer to God. It gives you huge satisfaction. This is a congregation, a festival of God. All our religious leaders come here.
The Kumbh Mela is an extraordinary logistical exercise, a big security challenge, but above all, a remarkable display of religious piety. It's held every 3 years in one of four holy riverside cities. They are the revered places where Hindu mythology says drops from a pitcher containing the nectar of immortality fell to earth during a fight between gods and demons. And that's why the devout believe that bathing here in the Ganges during the Kumbh helps heal the sick and prepare the soul for salvation.
I have washed out all my sins and I have started my new life after that, after this bath. This is the main reason. Thank you very much.
Just to get here to the water's edge is a monumental effort. It's estimated that more than 40 million people have bathed in the Ganges at Haridwar since this festival began in January. The numbers peak on special days such as this. And among the holy men and Hindu pilgrims are a small number of foreigners, some looking for spiritual meaning, others just plain curious.
I think it's great. It's millions of persons, so most of the countries, I think we should learn a lot how to keep the traditions and try to develop this.
It's okay, you know, because people are quiet and calm and it's really great experience. I like it so much.
Another Kumbh Mela is drawing to a close. Holy men and tourists alike are preparing to go their separate ways. But coming to this festival is a timely reminder that despite all the triumphs and tragedies of Indian life, amidst the cricket scandals, the poverty and the booming businesses, this remains a deeply devout country where religion still plays a central role in the lives of hundreds of millions of people.
Chris Morris reporting there from India. Well, we've been getting lots of emails about Gordon Brown's comments. So this from Jerry in Michigan in the US. I wish Brown had just said, I apologise to the lady. If I'd known I was being recorded, I would have said it differently. But the truth is that her views are far outside the mainstream. And we must stand up for what we believe. Orla in New York writes, politicians are human. Is it fair of us to expect them to enjoy being abused? And this from Harlan Holmes, who says, politicians been less than honest and forthright with us. Heavens, why, they're just like us after all, aren't they? Now, speak for yourself, Harlan. Keep the comments coming, though. Was it a bad gaffe? Or should politicians be freer to say what they think? World Have Your Say is our, at bbc.com is our email address. That's worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. Or you can continue the debate at our Facebook page. Just type in BBC World Service News Hour into the search engine and it will come up. But that's about it for this edition of the programme. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for listening. Goodbye.